Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's podcast features Keith Barnes, co-author of Birds of Greater Southern Africa. This spectacular field guide includes all resident, breeding, and migrant species found in Greater Southern Africa, comprising South Africa, Lesotho, Eswatini, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Malawi, Mozambique, and Zambia. Greater Southern Africa is a vast region and home to a truly extraordinary diversity of avifauna. This book describes all 1,170 regularly occurring species that are likely to be encountered in the region, from the wandering albatross to the pennant-winged nightjar, featuring 272 colored plates by three of the world's leading bird illustrators. Fully illustrated throughout, this is an essential reference guide for anyone visiting or living in this wildlife-rich area. In this episode of PageCast, Keith is in conversation with Christian Boyce, author of Africa Geographic. Enjoy the chat.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Christian Boyce. I have the great pleasure of spending this morning with you and my friend and sort of university, you could even call him childhood colleague, Keith Barnes, which has endeavored to produce an amazing bird guide for Greater Southern Africa. We're going to spend the next hour talking about it and discussing the book. My background, I studied at UCT with Keith, botany and zoology. We then branched out to become birdwatching tour guides, you know, in Southern Africa, then the rest of the world. I did that for a good 10, 12 years and then decided that I needed more time for my family. And I joined Africa Geographic, with whom I've been for the last 15 years, I think. And I am now director of the travel department for Africa Geographic. Africa Geographic has evolved quite a bit from being, you know, a well-known travel and conservation and conservation and travel magazine to becoming a travel company with probably one of the most prestigious magazines on African conservation, people and travel. And that is, that's in a nutshell what I'm doing. I'm busy creating, you know, responsible tourism packages for our clients and trying to promote companies and organizations that, you know, promote a sustainable travel. That's me in a nutshell. And I would like now to introduce Keith to introduce himself.
Thanks, Christian. So I started off life as a student with Christian, and we both ended up traveling around Africa and using field guides. So that's why Christian is a great person to be doing this interview. And originally, I started off as a bit of an academic working in the conservation side of bird stuff, longline fisheries, and then more related to selecting priority areas and what we call red data book species, which are sort of threatened bird species for a while. And then we sort of segued into travel in the mid-90s. And one of the first sorts of places we ended up going were places like Malawi and Zambia, where there were no field guides. And so that was kind of the inspiration to do this. But I'm also involved in the travel industry now with a company called Tropical Bird.
So I think, you know, I've received a copy of your book. So thank you very much. I've had a most amazing time paging through it. I moved to the UK about 5 years ago, and it says the stuff of nostalgia. Not only the stuff of nostalgia, but it's an incredible book. I think it's a step forward in many grounds in terms of field guides. The first question that came to my mind as I paged through it was, what was your motivation to do it? What drove you to do it?
So, you would remember back in the day, right? It was, maybe 1995, and we planned a trip up to Malawi, and we got up there, and we started looking around, and there were birds that were in no books, and it was confusing, it was fun, and it was exciting for sure to see these things that hadn't been illustrated before, hadn't been described. And so you'd make your notes like you did in the day. You know, there were no apps or anything back then. So we'd scribble down, well, it's had this kind of colored head and this kind of color throat and boom. And then you'd go back to the Fitzpatrick Library. And we were so lucky we had this magnificent library, the Niven Library at the University of Cape Town, at the Fitzpatrick Institute Department of Zoology, and page through the old books. And Bannerman's was one of the original 1950s published books. And it was just this dense words. I mean, it was just like word salad in that thing. Remember, it was, and there's complicated names and jargon, and you have to. And eventually I paged through these things and work out what we'd seen up in this country that seemed like the edge of the world to us back in those days, because South Africa had just come out of apartheid. It was the first time we were allowed in these places. It was really, really a cool time to be around. And it was back then that the seed was set. And I was just so sure that, people would eventually do a good field guide for Malawi and Zambia and Mozambique. And as time went by, it just never happened. Time just continued going. And eventually, I got to know guys like John Gale and Brian Small, and their book, To the Birds of East Africa, was also really inspirational when it came out. And they were sort of wonderful, beautiful artists that crafted these books that were immaculate to look at and gorgeous, but accurate, with great text by Terry Stevenson and John Fanshawe. And I just thought, if I'm ever going to do a field guide, I want it to be with these guys. And so that's what planted the seed of being able to do the book. And then it was also about really placing the Southern African region, which is the, just for those, the listeners who don't know that are interested in birds, the countries of South Africa, Eswatini, Lesotho, Namibia, Botswana, and Southern Mozambique. In a very weird way, the Kuneni and the Zambezi rivers, and Zimbabwe, the borders of the Kuneni and the Zambezi rivers, that makes up the classic region. And so to be able to feature countries to the north of that, and also the waters and the islands to the south of that, places that region within context. Everybody, and still a lot of people, view that region almost as having these hard borders that are not contiguous with the rest of the planet. And so it's kind of fun, even for those folks who are only interested in those countries in that region, to sort of see how biology and ornithology and birding works in the border regions around those countries. So that was really the main motivation factors for doing it.
Following on that, what made you decide to exclude places like Angola or, some of the, I know you've included a lot of the island, and they're pretty far. But Angola is right next to us.
Right,
and
right.
It didn't crack the knot somehow.
Yeah. It's part of the, it would be part of the same biogeographic region in some ways, with all that Miombo woodland that flows across Zambia and into Angola. But it does introduce one little fly in the ointment when you get into Angola, is that the forests that come down from, the DRC and places like that filter in. And so there ends up being a lot of additional forest-based birds. And we're already covering 1,200 species in this book. That is, a significant proportion of the birds of Africa. And so if you started including all these forest birds, it would probably add 100 species. And then the book becomes that much more bulky and that much more clumsy. So we had to kind of draw some kind of line somewhere. And I guess I would have liked to have done Angola, but it also looks like it's now subject of a new book. So it's great that Angola is getting a field guide. And it's important to put that out there, that somebody else will be doing that. It was also a part of the world that I was much less familiar with. Angola had been one of those countries, because of the civil war, that had sort of remained unbirdable for a long time. And since it had become birdable, I hadn't really been there. And so I didn't feel comfortable with my knowledge base talking about what was going on in Angola, whereas I was quite comfortable with everywhere else covered in the book.
I think you're right. I think in this case, when it comes to field guides, size does matter. What would you say is really different about this book? What do you think makes it special or different if we compare it to the other existing guides in Southern Africa? Because in Southern Africa, it's a highly competitive field for field guides. I think in terms of African countries, it must be the one that has the most number of guides, identification guides, and reference books. for the different families and groups of birds. It's pretty bold to go and do another guide.
Yeah, you're right. We do have great resources in the region. And so and that's kind of why I needed John and Brian and Fancy and the other guys involved in the project, I felt, because if it wasn't going to be a step above what was already available, there was no point in doing it. So I didn't want to do a book that didn't have the illustration quality that could put it out there as being one of the best, if not the best. And I didn't want to do it that way. I think what makes it different is we've already covered a little bit of this, is its coverage of the parts of the region outside of Southern Africa, right? So that helps you sort of place it in context. And then another thing that I think is quite unique about this book is a lot of people will sort of say to you, just provide the minimal amount of information that it takes to reach a species ID. And I know a lot of people are obsessed with species, and getting down to a species identification is important, but I wanted to change the narrative a little bit, and I wanted this to be more about getting back to the roots of birding and understanding variation and variability in birds. And part of that was I really don't like it, for example, when you'll sort of say, well, whatever bird, so-and-so a palus, 12 centimeters. Well, I promise you, if you go and measure those birds, they're not all 12 centimeters, right? They vary from 11 to maybe 12 and a half or something like that. So one element was giving people an impression of size variability in these things. But then also we ended up discussing every single subspecies. So every single race that has ever been recorded in the region, the whole region, is covered in one way or another. It's quite hard to be concise when you're covering so many different things. So sometimes it would be a case of, let's say, a bird like Southern Black Flycatcher, which doesn't actually vary that much in its plumage, but we supposedly have these different races across the region. I would just try and give you an indication, more or less, of where you were in, like, northwest Zambia, which one of the races would you be looking at? If you're in southeast Botswana, which of the races are you looking at? And, the other thing I learned, Christian, when doing it was, wow, man, that racial stuff is so misaligned when you look at the other major global taxonomies. Like, some of them will turn around and say, slowly gets smaller from north to south. And then you read another one of the major taxonomies and gets larger from north to south. It's like, which one is it, guys? There's quite a lot of, I'm putting this out there because I think that when people use the book, they'll find that we can improve the knowledge base by having real expert birders. And we know we've got great expert birders in Southern Africa looking critically at what's in the book and saying, well, wait a minute, this taxon in Northeast Gauteng doesn't really match up with what's in the book. Maybe it's a bit different. And so I'm hoping, number one, and I do think it's as accurate as possible, but the literature is sometimes not always 100% accurate. So getting people to start looking at things like subspecies, I think, is important. Getting back to the details of bird watching, so you can understand variations in subspecies, in males and females, in different kinds of molt and plumage. I haven't gone too crazy on the molt stuff because I don't think it's very interesting or fun. And so we've still got to have a book that works a little bit. But sometimes molt can be a really, really cool way of telling apart, like, really tricky birds. So maybe redneck stint and little stint, which are just almost practically identical, knowing a couple of features about their molt can be really, really important in picking up a bird in early March or something when they start molting into breeding plumage, right? So a couple of the other things we did, we have only a couple of main illustrators. And so that gives this kind of book, and not only that, high quality illustrators, but it gives it a sort of uniformity, a nice visual aesthetic. Now, lots of the other books lack consistency with the illustrations. They may have 10 or 15 different illustrators across the book.
I have to say that those illustrations are next level. They the fact that you're not dealing with different types of art throughout the book, the fact that they're very, very much aligned, and there's the way they're playing with the shadows and the way the birds are popping out, it's almost like we've gone from 2D illustrations to 3D illustrations. I was really impressed. It really made me homesick. I've seen most of the birds in that book, and I want to see them all over again just to check if the book works.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the illustrations are a joy to look at, I think, but they were also done 100%. You try to make them 100% accurate. You know, the artists were great to work with. If there were any issues with any of the plumages, they would go back and correct them. And then we took some of the pre-existing illustrations from the Birds of East Africa, but then each of those were carefully and meticulously digitally modified by Julie Dando to make sure that the taxa, the subspecies we're dealing with in the region, are accurately done. And so I've still got a few more things to tell you about how it differs, by the way. Yeah. So because we were able to, you know, in a lot of books, also they're kind of hardwired into this idea that we need to present five species on this plate. And then you get to the next plate. There's five species on that plate. I approached it quite differently. So I said, if we're dealing with birds that are easily told apart, like the beaters and, you know, rollers and things like that, you don't need to go too crazy on the text, right? Because you've got these great illustrations. You need to basically point out a handful of things about this bird to get people onto the main features that are going to help them identify. But then all of a sudden, you know, you're dealing with birds like, so these great albatrosses, things like wandering albatross, things like the migrant harriers, like pallid and Montagu's harriers. They're easy as adult males, but the females are tough. The juveniles are really tricky. And so on some of those, I was able to present as little as few as two species per plate. So if you go to the lesser blackback gull complex, there are three major taxa in there. And I basically got 21 illustrations for that group of birds, and it's a single species. And we've got over 800 words of text because they're so tricky to tell apart. So when you're dealing with a bird that's very, very hard to tell apart, I've got room and detail to be able to really go into it. When you've got an bird that's easy to tell apart, I don't waste words. So that's been a really, really cool element to the project that I think not a lot of the other guides tick. We try to look at immature plumage, sexual dimorphism, all the variations. And then I think the introduction also tackles something that's a little bit different. We kind of go into habitat detail a bit. And I think not a lot of other guides really deal with habitats in great detail in other field guides. And I think that's such an important element of birding these days. Audience is an international one. It's different in that I've tried to stick with a international style taxonomy and nomenclature. And for listeners who don't know what that is, it's like what the species are, how we divvy them up, but also what we call them, what names we give them. You know, I know South Africans really, really love their local names, and I do too. I mean, I love Aluri. I love these all these sorts of cool birds. I love a koran myself, but we've got to understand that we're dealing with folks in Zambia. We're dealing with folks who, you know, we've included territories that include the French subantarctic islands. When you've got people, when it's as inclusive as that, you've really got to move closer towards an international standard that keeps things on the same track. So we're all speaking the same language. The other cool thing about the taxonomy, by the way, is, and this can cause a lot of, people get a lot of, get fussed about what taxonomy you used. And I'm actually, you know, I was a trained taxonomist. I did a PhD in taxonomy. And yet when it came to doing a bird field guide, I decided I'm not going to push any taxonomy, you know? So although I've had to choose a kind of taxonomy, I've tried to provide the detail there that if you want a yellow-billed kite and you want a black kite, the detail's there for you to work it out. I'm not going to shove it down your throat. You've got the details. You've got all these potential splits. We've dealt with how you identify them. And so I'm trying not to step on any toes of people who get very excited about taxonomy and just give them the information they need to do that. But yeah, that I think is in a nutshell, well, a little bit more than a nutshell, what makes a book different. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's interesting to hear. There was a lot of species to include in this book and to cover. And I can see where space constraint became a major challenge. Still, the end product is 640 pages. Do you think that is that makes it like a suitable guide for the team?
Christian, it is on the slightly heavier side, and that's because I did want it to be detailed. You know, I wanted people to have access to the information they really need. There's nothing more frustrating than carrying a book out in the field and then, you know, you see a Jaeger without any, or a skua without any tail plumes, and it's kind of all natty and tatty, and you look in your book and you don't have the information there to be able to nail it down. That's more frustrating to me, carrying a book that doesn't quite provide you with that sort of detail. So I wanted to have it there. When I checked it against the other major guides, it's a little bit lighter than even some of the photographic guides that already deal with only Southern Africa, the classic region rather than the expanded region. It's a little bit heavier than something like Sasol. And yeah, it's a fair bit heavier than Roberts, which is a nice, compact, concise guide. The other thing is who's really walking around in the field with books anymore these days? You take it in your car, or you keep it at home, or you have it nearby, but you're not exactly carrying it with you in a backpack. You've got an app, you're using Merlin maybe in the field, or some kind of digital media on your phone. And yeah, you know, if it means you have to make a couple of notes and then head back rather than carrying the thing with you 100% of the time, I think
most people are walking with a camera these days as well. Which
exactly. Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. So that's another big game changer, right? Everybody's got a digital camera. They bring the bird back with them. And then if the book doesn't help you, you go to Facebook or some social media group and somebody's going to find it and be able to help you. So this sort of classic idea that a field guide has to be very light and very portable. I mean, obviously it's nice if they are. It's not a deal breaker really as to whether you're going to buy it or not. It's still, and yeah, I did check it out, you know, and other people were sort of saying it was kind of funny because, but you know, your maps aren't going to be as big and we're not going to be able to see the detail. So I thought about this a bit and I went and I actually measured the maps and the maps are larger than they are in most of the other plate-driven field guides. And then, okay, we are covering for all the terrestrial land birds, we're covering a fair wider geographical region. So then I went and measured like from the Caprivi Strip down to Cape Town, you know, and the maps are exactly the same size. So I really don't think the size of the maps are an issue. I think the book is compact enough to be handy in the field if you want to take it into the field. But like you say, most people probably aren't doing it that much anymore. So yeah, I'm very comfortable with the size of the book. I think the quality of the illustrations. And the other thing that was really cool is unlike in a lot of the guides are getting there for sure. There's good recognition of the racial variation. But I said I treated all the different races in the region in the text, but I think a lot of them are also treated in the illustrations. So a good example will be red-necked spurfowl. You know, so red-necked spurfowl is quite a variable bird across the sub-region. There's some versions that are very, very dark underneath with chestnut flank streaks, and some of the birds have white faces like up in northern Namibia. And so we've got at least five different taxa illustrated there, which is really, really neat, you know. So people are getting a really good feel for that. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And I think, I mean, I know that there's a subspecies work. The Hugh Chitton was involved in that in Southern Africa. So if this book actually allows you to carry one book as opposed to two on your trip to Namibia if you're constrained for space. And I have to agree, like, yeah, going back to the point you made early on, when I was studying parts of my postgrad studies in Namibia, I had a chance to spend a lot of time up, you know, in the Kunene River, and just like it happened to us in Malawi, it was, you know, some of those species that we were looking at, and you know, we were doing some bird ringing at the time, and we had them in the hand, and it was striking, and you were wondering, where are we? Where are these birds? There's no guide carrying these birds. Why, you know, things like scimitar, things like you know, grey-headed bushrock, and you know, the Franklin, even
light-spotted woodpeckers.
Yeah, exactly. Cinderella waxbills. Like they, you know, I was looking at the guys, and there were features missing in them, and then it kind of dawned on me, like, you know, a lot of the West African museums that are gathering all these collections were not very accessible, you know, 20, 25 years ago. You know, it was very difficult. And I can only imagine that a lot of the skins that were used and most of the birding and photos that were coming out was very East African skewed. So a lot of our guides were done out of skins and bird photos and features that were very East African. So it's all the subspecies from the West were kind of like kind of like dark zone, dark area, not right. treated. So you were there in this area, and you thought, okay, what's rare about Namibia? It's Southern Africa, you know. But mm-hmm. No, it's you know, Permian is like filled with all these like West African morphs and varieties and subspecies that are very different to the eastern one. So I think, yeah, it opens a very exciting sort of birding opportunity for the curious, for the you know, sort of both the starting and the professional or the well-heeled birder in Southern Africa to I'm sure try and go and nab all these little subspecies that may have been overlooked.
Yeah, you could go. We call them banking. We call it banking, right? So you know, if you're a twitcher and you really really care about your list of species, you're like, you want to go and get those things in the bank to make sure that in future, if any taxonomists come along and split them, that you've got them in the bank already. So I think the book's really great for that. It gives you every single bankable bird in the region, of course, based on current understanding and work, because we learn more and more every year. So, yeah, but that's what's fun about it too.
So, all right. So now we've expanded this whole area. Theoretically, you've expanded this whole area that is now birdable in Southern Africa. Not that the book is now covering it, and I see it as an expansion, because I know a lot of people that don't want to leave beyond. They do live, but they do it like, you know, carefully. They don't want to leave the confines of the well-known Southern Africa, especially in times where, you know, rarities and, you know, vagrants may rock up. And now you've pushed the borders all the way to the top of Zambia and Malawi and Mozambique. So what would you say to, you know, your classic Southern African birder that maybe feels that they don't need this book, that has expanded and that has included all these new regions, which I find very interesting. But some people might feel that it's much more work to the lifetime achievement of seeing every single bird that flew over, landed, pooped or pecked in Southern Africa, the Southern Africa that we know.
Right. Yeah. Look, Christian, you know, I mean, nobody has to believe in a greater Southern African region or anything like that. And I'm sure some folks won't, and that's fine. I remember this vividly, right, going down to the Fitz and that library. If I had a spare moment, I'd be in that library poring through some book somewhere. And I'll never forget, there was a little journal called Scopus, which was the Journal of East African Ornithology or something like that. And I was flipping through. They had black and white photos. I mean, it's terrible. I can't even believe this stuff got me excited back in the day, but it did. And I found this image of a bird called the dapple-throated mountain modulatrix. And I just blew my head, right? I was like, what is this thing? All right. And I mean, it's a pretty dull little bird, actually. And I think the name probably did it more than anything else. And it subsequently become known as dapple throat. But suddenly there's a book where young birders, or maybe older birders, whatever birders, will pick it up. And all of a sudden it's going to be, oh, wow, you know, there's Schubel's just up there. There's Namulia palis just down the road. There's dapple throats. What are these things? So even if people just, it expands their horizons in a way that they understand the context of the region and what's to the north and the south, they may never visit those countries or use the book in those countries. And that's fine. If they don't, what it does do, and why I would say to them that this is still a great book to own, is think about the things that are most likely to turn up in Southern Africa as rarities or vagrants. They're going to be the 200 species that are recorded in the regions just outside of that main region. And guess what? Our book covers every single square inch of the areas around the main regions. So I think your most likely set of new birds or new vagrants to pitch up in Southern Africa are likely to be already covered in our book. And I also included something in the back of the book, an appendix, which was called the Vagrant Watch List. And it's, you know, it's kind of fun, because what I focused on there was not just things that are potential vagrants to the region, but things that are potential vagrants that are likely to be confused with something that's already in the region. In other words, what do you need to know before you go into the field to be able to identify this kind of pterodroma petrel, this gadfly petrel? Are you gonna need to know, oh gee, or at least know enough that when you see it, you think, hey, wait a minute, I remember that photo from, or the picture from the illustration from the Greater Southern Africa book. There's a bird here I see with white lines inside the flight feathers on the primaries. That looks like a Kermadec petrel. Maybe I should take a picture of that thing. So I think that Southern African birders will benefit from that. I also think that Zambia, Malawi, and Mozambique, despite being, and let's face it, Southern Africa in general is one of the most birded parts of Africa, if not the most birded part of Africa. It's probably got the largest community of seriously good, accurate bird watchers out there who are amazing. I think that countries like Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique have really struggled to get serious birders to visit them because there hasn't been a book for those places that was really, really good enough.
Yeah.
And so that's one change. And then the other change is if our Southern African birders do start venturing north, I mean, there's a guy, Frank Willems, in Zambia. I mean, it was so funny. So the book's already out of date, by the way, even though it was only published in February. He just went up to the north and found three new species of rainforest birds from the DRC that he discovered in a forest patch on the Zambian border. So already the book's out of date, you know. So that's it. There is so much to be discovered in these places for intrepid birders who really want to go and feel like they're stomping new ground. And let's face it, like northern Zambia, beautiful, you know, wilderness areas, Luwa Plains. I mean, up along the Ikilenga Rivers, you know, there's some awesome places out there for folks to discover and enjoy. And I do think that having, like, as a potential listing region, I think Southern Africa will always be the first and foremost listing region out there for folks. But for well-heeled birders who are intrepid, who maybe have seen most of the things in Southern Africa, sort of working on your Greater Southern Africa list wouldn't be a bad thing, because number one, you can help contribute to the knowledge base that's out there, especially with great programs out there these days like Bird Lassa and eBird contributing distribution data of birds, but also just a sense of exploration and enjoying new areas. There's a lot of folks out there who have already seen every single resident bird in Southern Africa, you know, and they're sitting around drinking cups of tea waiting for vagrants to add to their list. So This gives them a new project.
I think there's also like a huge scope and potential for, you know, greater conservation of areas that if they don't get visited and they don't get valued for what they contain, the way things are going, they might disappear. Forests might get chopped down or burned, and grasses may be overgrazed. And, you know, the more people that go out there and give value to areas that are remote and unknown, the greater help they are doing to, like, sort of large organizations like Africa Parks, which are basically trying to run and protect areas with whatever resources they can lay their hands on. And one of them is, campsites and camps. So the use of those campsites and camps is crucial for generating revenue too, that goes directly into the conservation of those areas. And we know that avian tourism, it's a big money churner in South Africa and in the whole of Southern Africa as well. So kind of with like spreading the love and, you know, onto these adjacent areas, and it's certainly very exciting areas to go into, like you say. I mean, you didn't quite mention, and it is a bit of a contentious area, northern Mozambique, but we all know that the sky is the limit with what can be found in some of those inselbergs and some of those riverine systems and, you know, big massifs up north that are utterly unexplored. And the time will come. It didn't take long for birding groups going into areas of Mozambique just below Pemba to find new species, right in front of our noses in patches of forest that are next to roads. So yeah, that's the spin-offs of opening up, you know, those areas are going, I think, are very exciting. I think it's going to be really exciting birding through that day.
And like you say, you know, I mean, well, you're right in that. Like, so, you know, Mount Tsholo, that forest nearly gone, man. So I think there's also already suggestions that some of the birds that were there are extinct. And so that would have been a perfect aviotourism project in southern Malawi if there had been any kind of market to create it, because you don't, you know, like we know with these smaller forest patches like Glinzo or somewhere in southern Africa, that's really worked positively in terms of creating a small local market. And a lot of birders go there and leave a little bit of money behind it. Might not be enough to save the whole forest, but it's certainly better than doing nothing. And then also, I think the tourism market in Zambia and Malawi, Zambia's obviously got a big safari industry that goes there. But some of the sort of more niche stuff on the sides, you know, other than the big fruit bat colonies and things like that, there's not a lot of that sort of thing happening. And so what that means is you get all this focus on the big national parks. Luangwa does great, Lua does great, blah, blah, blah. But then what about those little small ecotourism projects? Like when we look at Ghana, you know, think about what's happened at that town like Bonkro, where they discovered the Picathartes. You know, now suddenly there's an ecotourism project. There's a guest house. There's five guides that operate out of that place. And so these small little communities need things like birding and or other niche industries to have some kind of spin-offs in certain rural areas that don't quite have the big pool of elephants and lions and, you know.
I think what's like interesting also to point out is that, for example, in Malawi, all those areas, all the areas that held or still hold a lot of like really interesting species already had, you know, proper, nice, amazing accommodation and facilities to spend time and birdwatch those areas. Even I never really understood it. Even there's like this most amazing little cottage in Zalanyama Forest. I mean, it was there 20 years ago, you know, with the most unbelievable miombo species mucking about, including some really, really cool seedeaters like Nyasa sea cracker, which, you know, very difficult to see you know, in southern Africa. And quite frankly, you know, having tried it so many times down at the Hundi Valley, I wanted to see it. At least I wanted to see what it looks like. Okay. Yeah. So I went over there. Not only did I learn what it looks like, I could see the difference between males and females. I could see how the, you know, immatures look like. I then also like realized how they were moving and what time of the day they were moving, what they were doing. What sort of like behavior they had, how they compared to similar species in that area. And then you don't know it. You don't realize what you've just done, but you've armed yourself with all this information, headed down to Hundi Valley. Boom, that's it. I knew where to like set my eyes. I knew where to look. I knew where I didn't have to look, which is more importantly. I knew immediately I could tell which areas would be good for them. And as soon as the, you know, seed cracker moved, I knew that I was not looking at something that maybe was or maybe wasn't. I knew it was a seed cracker. So it's that there's nothing like, you know, the value of actually spending time with those species in the greater Southern Africa in order to identify species in the sort of classical Southern Africa is invaluable. But my point really was all those places have facilities and had facilities a long time ago, and areas are disappearing around them. They haven't been valued. They haven't been birded. They haven't been visited. They haven't been eyes and ears and boots on the ground calling, you know, calling out the decimation, in a timely manner. So it was all really left to the, you know, smaller Malawian birding community, when it could have been a massive shout out if the, you know, the greater Southern African birding community had put a stop to it or had voiced the feelings about those forests being, you know, disappearing. And the same applies to anywhere else in Southern Africa. So I think we need to really think about the fact that, you know, we've got a very amazing extension to our birding playground that is worth really exploring. And I think this book is the right tool to go and do so confidently.
Yeah, I do think that basically until you've got a book that really does a great job of covering an area, it's very hard to market it to birders as a destination, right? And I think at least we've sort of resolved that for now.
How would one start a new listing from the area? So I don't see no issue in people. I mean, we have lists from everything. We have lists of the birds we see from the toilet and on runways and everything. Why, you know, how do we start? How does one start like a greater Southern Africa listing region, you know?
Yeah, I do think there would be value in that. And I think we could easily have it and it be in a way that certainly doesn't compete with any other listing region, whether it's your garden list or your Southern Africa list or the next list or that. So it's a little bit like in the Western Palearctic, the way in Europe you'd have Brits have their British list, but then the more kind of Brits who like to travel and push the boundaries of exploration will have a much wider Western Palearctic list. And I see Greater Southern Africa list being a little bit like that. Not going to be for everybody, it'll be for a handful of people, but hopefully it'll attract the kinds of birders that are A, experienced, and B, get excited by exploration, because that's what those regions really need, right? The other cool thing would be if there was a list for Greater Southern Africa, for example, when these Flock to Marion trips that BirdLife South Africa are putting together go, we don't have this weird disconnect where all of a sudden we leave the region's waters within 200 nautical miles. And then next thing, we're in the South African waters around Marion Island, but there's no waters in between, and that's on a world list. So I do think that would work well. Yeah,
I have to say it does open a very, very exciting prospect for makes you want to be like 30 years younger and do it and do it all over again. You know,
hopefully the young kids do get the sort of bit between their teeth and run with it. And I think it is more likely to appeal to younger people, a wider listing region than some of the older folks. But let's see.
Yeah, I think, also the way that one can source information of where to go bird watching and who are, you know, people in the know in certain areas that can help you find the right spots, the right sort of stakeouts, the right areas to walk. I mean, there's so much information this day that makes planning, you know, a birding trip into a lot of these areas a lot simpler than it was in the olden days when we had to like read all those trip reports from like sort of birding companies and then try and figure out with paper maps, you know, where we'd trace our trip and where we would be sleeping. And then that often there was we had to like phone, you know, so there's exchange lines to find the place to sleep in Mutinondo. And,
I think we're aging ourselves, Christian.
Now it's just it's so much easier, so much more exciting. You can spend so much more time doing what we really like, which is, boots on the ground, things around the neck and chasing birds and with a tool that's helping us, differentiate the different species in that region. And there's some, incredible birds to be seen and found and discovered, I reckon, still in those areas.
I think northern Mozambique could be a place where you could still pull out a new species for science across the board, you know. So there is some exciting stuff to still be done in these places.
So we are dealing with young kids, and we're dealing with a lot of people that are going to be going up birding into all this greater Southern Africa. And we here in Africa, we have I guess it doesn't matter like that. We've got very good mobile connectivity, but throughout Southern Africa. But is there any plans to convert the book into an app? Something that can contain even more information than it has and can be carried in our mobile phones. Is that something that's in the plans?
Christian, I think to make things a little bit more mobile, we're planning a couple of things. One is to have an app version that'll also have bird calls and photos on, so you can check out a little bit extra media other than just the really, really amazing illustrations and the text. And that's happening. But at the moment, we just got it as an ebook. So I know the ebook is available already. If that's what you want to buy, the app's still going to be a little while in development. And then I'm also hoping to potentially, certainly somewhere like Zambia and Malawi probably deserves a separate country guide. And we're talking about doing separate country guides. So that's in the works. I do think that there will be future editions. And so I'm hoping that we can incorporate more information and use the space a little bit better. Definitely. So that's all in the plans.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I know. It's exciting. I'm glad to finally see it in print. And let's hope the readers love it. Yeah, let's hope it gets sold and people use it.
Congratulations to you and Terry and all the artists. And I would like just to say that the book is available already in all good bookshops in South Africa. It is also available online. And there's a very nice, I believe, very nice special for in South Africa going on. Log online. The Birds is called Birds of Greater Southern Africa. Have a look at it and get it into your library, get it in your hands, page through it, enjoy it, and dream.
Thanks, Christian. It was great talking. Appreciate the interview. That was really cool.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. Good to see you again.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.